On this episode of the Boag World Show, we look at how to make your designs more persuasive and how far you should go in the pursuit of conversion. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Balsamic and Full Story. Show the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development, and strategy. My name is Paul Boag, and joining me on this week's show is Marcus Lillington and Joe Leach. Hello, all.
Hello.
Testing.
Is this thing on?
1, 2, 3. Is it? Yeah. So, you got back from Switzerland, okay? Then, Marcus.
Sorry. Yes, I've just been having a call with the Swiss people. And I messed up because they're an hour ahead, and when I saw that I had the podcast recording in my calendar, and I thought I had to add an hour when I took an hour away or something like that. So I was halfway through a very important meeting with a client and I had to go bye.
Oh, so and here you are now.
But anyway, and here I am.
We're more important.
This is more important, clearly.
You kind of are, because I'm here, obviously. So there you go.
Wonderful.
Did you say, go away, client, I've got something more important to do?
No. I said, I've messed up. I can't get out of this one. But no, Switzerland was gorgeous as ever. It was all sort of snowy and gorgeous.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Did you come away with chocolate?
Always.
Good.
Every meeting room at Nestle, where we were, has chocolate in it.
Wow.
How good is that?
Yes. I once met a woman who worked for an agency who did work for Ben & Jerry's ice cream.
Wow.
And they got a fridge delivered from Ben & Jerry's to their office, which was continually filled with Ben & Jerry's ice cream. All the time. They just constantly topped it up.
Wow. That's a gig and a half, isn't it?
I have never had a client like that, and my life is poorer for it, is all I can say.
Well, this is the only client that ever sends us things, and they send us chocolates at Christmas.
That's really nice.
Which is nice.
I did do some work from Ritz-Carlton once, and that
nice.
That was great, because I got to stay in Ritz-Carlton's, so that was good for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I worked with Jack Daniels for a few years and became an alcoholic.
Oh,
so, no, you didn't.
I know, but it was funny. Vaguely
funny. Yeah,
let's joke about alcoholism. That always goes down well.
Yes. So, which parts of the show do I have to edit out this week?
Yes. Well, at least Andy Clark's not on the show. That always damages its political correctness.
Absolutely.
But instead, we have the very lovely Joe Leach.
Hi.
Hello, Joe.
Hello.
How's the black eye?
The black eye is good. Yeah, I look like I've been in a street brawl. I got attacked by 14 ninjas and my 14-month-year-old daughter. She got the killer blow in while I was fending the ninjas off, and I got given a black eye by my 14-month-old daughter. So I'm looking like
a
streetballer.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's children for you. It just all goes downhill from there, really, Joe.
Oh well, great. That's all that to look forward to.
Yeah, that's really good. Like I was saying just before we recorded, the real dangerous time is where they're at groin height and they're not particularly stable on their feet. That
Absolutely.
Gets very dangerous.
Lots of grabbing, I can imagine. Yeah, not a very nice position to be in, really.
It's headbutting. They run headlong at you.
Oh, kids, eh? Kids. Who'd have
exactly.
I headbutted on the nose by my grandson this weekend. But I didn't get there was no blood or black eyeness going on. So, but yeah, I know the feeling.
It's because you're a pro now. You've learned. You've got those subtle movements that are just inbuilt from all those years of experience of getting your eyes out of the way of babies' heads.
You forget it all. Ah. Every single minute bit of it is forgotten until they come along again.
Oh, yes. Well, all you need to remember, I've made a mental note now, is I need to remember to wear a crash helmet at all times around my grandchildren.
There
if I have
go.
Any.
There we go.
course you will, Paul.
Well, I don't know, James.
Hordes of them.
Well, I've only got one child myself, so he's going to have to get super busy if I'm going to end up with hordes of them. He might choose not to have any children. Who he knows? Might live, live alone on a pile of poo as a hermit.
Where did that come from?
Something to aspire to.
You haven't seen his bedroom, so it's not such a great leap. You know, teenage boy to sitting on a pile of poo. It could happen. Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had a teenage boy. You must
I
know
have
what
no
it's like.
Response. Yeah, I did. And he was, he still is quite messy, even though he's how old's James now? 23. He's like a proper grown up now, but he's still messy and still a bit like that. But he's lovely as well. Very lovely.
Well, yeah, they can be lovely and disgusting at the same time. Yeah. I look at him sometimes and I think, how can I love you so much? Look at the state of you.
Is he big now?
Well, big vertically, but not horizontally.
Oh, like mine then. Yeah, I mean, James is still under 10 stone. And he's 6 foot two, I think, or three even.
Wow.
Yes, complete opposite of me.
Yeah. You know,
I'm like a dwarf from the Lord of the Rings.
Do you know what? Now you say that out loud, that makes a lot of sense. That's it. You've got dwarvish ancestry. Yeah.
That's what it is. It's from Devon, that's why.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll shut up. Let Joe talk. He's the guest.
Yeah, but it's Joe.
Yeah.
So that's all right. Well, no, it's always the way. Don't you find it? It's like, you know...
Can't get a word in edgeways. That's the problem I hear with this show. Is that
My
guest complaint is that you come on and you don't say very much.
Well, exactly. We don't think it's about the guest. You know, it's about me. It always has been.
Yes.
Everybody knows.
The clue is in the name, after all.
Exactly. Oh, God. How if I ever knew anybody was going to read my blog, I might have thought twice about that title. It's Pete Boston's fault, isn't it, Marcus? Do you remember that?
Is it? I don't know. That's far too far in the distant mire of time.
Well, yeah, but
did he come up with it then?
Yeah, I thought as you get older, you're supposed to remember things further back, Marcus.
That's a good point.
He's supposed to have good long-term memory. No, it was so... It all started because Pete Boston took the piss out of me for living in my own little world, which he coined as being Boag World, so I bought the domain name.
Kind of
here we
sense.
Are.
Exactly. So it's all his fault.
You know what?
Although
I
mean, you can't talk my... Joe, Mr. Joe. Where did Mr. Joe come from? Did you? Were people not giving you enough respect?
Generally, now I used to be before all this internet thing took off. I was an English teacher. I used to teach English as a foreign language. I taught a lot of Japanese kids, and they could never pronounce my surname, and they could never just call me Joe informally. So they always used to call me Mr. Joe. So it's my old name as a teacher. So when I was doing the same thing, looking for a domain, I grabbed Mr. Joe.
It's funny, isn't it, that we've all been lumbered with these domains that basically are meaningless. You know, it's like. I mean, does anybody know? Do you know where Jeremy Keith's domain name, Adachio, comes from?
Oh, that will be some Greek mythology and totally deliberate.
Extremely smart and very, very clever reason behind where it came from, almost certainly. But, you know, we have to count our blessings. At least we're not, you know, at least you're not Boag World 63 or, you know, and I'm Mr. Joe 99. So, at the very least, we did get in there a little bit earlier than other people who share our nicknames that I'm sure there are many of.
Well, yeah, that's just true. I'm somewhat unusual. But I always feel sorry for Lee, because that can backfire on you. Because Lee, who's one of the designer stroke consultant people at Headscape, he got in with myself very early on in Twitter, and he actually managed to get the username Lee, L-E-I-G-H, which you think, wow, that's great. Isn't that wonderful? Except that he regularly gets tweets for other people.
Oh, yeah, I'm the same with Mr. Joe. I get loads of tweets for other people with Mr. Joe. Instagram as well. I get. So I got. So Instagram, I have the same thing. I'm Mr. Joe on Instagram. And once, it was about 2 years ago, I accidentally got tagged in a photo that Paris Hilton took. Obviously, because that's the sort of people that's the circles I move in, is you guys and Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
And I got. So she mistagged me in a photo. And I'm. overnight, I picked up about 2,500 followers by being mistagged by Paris Saint. She did it on Twitter as well. Because Mr. Joe is also the fashion editor for Yahoo Style. And so, yeah, I got mistagged and there we go. Yeah, I gathered a lot more followers. Some really odd people. I've this one guy who still follows me and comments on lots of the stuff that I post on Instagram back from that incident. He's a nice chap, but
do you think, does he realise that you're not actually close with Paris Hilton?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've not ever explicitly said I'm not. So I think it's probably obvious from my Instagram feed, which is full of dogs and babies, that I'm probably not that close to Paris Hilton. My life is not that exciting, really. No. Or glamorous, really. Hence the black eye.
But you're happier for it.
I'm much happier for it. Exactly. But yeah, I do get a lot of miss ats on both Instagram and Twitter because of my name.
Because talking to you being happy, we did meet up for lunch recently and we basically just sat there feeling smug for a couple of hours, didn't we, as we went on
about... It was
really
nice, actually. It was nice to, as I said at the time, it was nice to have a conversation with you without a microphone on for a change. So it was quite a pleasant thing to talk about, really. But here we are back having a conversation with microphones on, so...
Most of my life, I recorded that lunch. You do know that.
Is that going to be a bonus edition of the of the podcast?
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's some good stuff in that lunch conversation. So if you do listen to it, there was some genuinely good advice we gave each other, I think.
I know. It was a mutual helping one another out, wasn't it?
It was.
But who's that guy? Justin TV that streamed his entire life, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
Didn't he?
So I'll do that then. No, it was good. It was really good to meet and talk about, you know, independent consulting life and you know, I told you your hourly rate wasn't high enough and you told me my workshop rate wasn't high enough. So basically we just egged each other on to charge clients more, didn't we? I think that's what it about boiled down to.
Yeah, we did. And do you know what? I think that's something that's a bit of an issue in our industry generally. Sort of the big folks, like the, you know, the big management consultancies who charge a fortune. I think most of us probably aren't charging enough for our services. I mean, if you're a client listening to this, I do apologise. But obviously we deliver value, but it's, you know, that the rates we charge compared to what the skills that we offer, you know, compared to hiring somebody from one of those awful Accenture or one of those awful management consultancies to do web stuff, we, you know, the value is definitely there.
It's funny, isn't it, how that works, mine? Because it especially in our kind of, when you start doing consultancy stuff, a lot of it is like the more you charge, the more value you're perceived to give, whether you do or not, which is why people love these big management consultancies, because they can, I don't know, because they charge a lot.
£2,500 a day, they must be, you know, the advice must be worth £2,500 a day. When, you know, having worked alongside them, they're nice people, but the advice is rarely worth that much.
No.
Anyway.
Agreed. Mm. I can't find out what adactio means. He doesn't tell anyone anywhere, and it doesn't seem to mean anything else.
He probably he made up a word, didn't he, to sound clever.
Yeah, well, no, it's probably part of a big quiz to see if you can be part of the really clever club. And I can't.
No. I'm not even going to try. That's how confident I am that I wouldn't get into the clever club. I'm not even going to waste my time doing it. So there we go. So we've got Joe on the show this week to talk about, well, persuasion and psychology and things like that. Because you wrote a book on this, didn't you, a while back?
I did, yeah. I wrote a book called Psychology for Designers. I did, about... the last edition was about 18 months ago that I published the last edition.
Oh, right. So you so you actually
But the original
update
was
it?
four and a half years ago. Yeah, I updated it.
Wow.
Fairly recently.
So have you got a background in this? Are you, like, qualified, or are you, like me, just making bullshit up as you go along?
Do you know what? Yes, I do. And I'd like to say it was a grand plan to bring myself to this moment in time when I would be a consultant looking at how to apply psychology in the digital design world, but it wasn't. At 16, I sort of had the choice of doing a computer science degree or a degree in neurobiology. And computer science was just, you know, I looked at it and it didn't really fill me full of excitement, but the neuroscience one did. So it was just a choice I sort of made, you know, at 16 without really knowing what I was getting myself into. So yeah, I have a degree in neuropsychology. And I also have a master's in human-computer interaction, which is the study of how people interact with technology and physical objects. So kind of like ergonomics, but for computer software. So I have a master's in that from Bath University, which I did about 14 years ago.
Oh, good university as well. Very, very well done.
Thank you very much.
Apparently. I don't know. I'm very much out of my depth at this point. Intelligent people talking about intelligent things is not my strength. And then you went and worked with, almost helped found CX Partners, didn't you? Which
That's
is
right.
a huge yeah. monstrosity of an agency at this
yeah,
point.
Yeah, they're pretty big these days. So they're I was employee number 3 at CX Partners. That would have been about 10 years ago now. And I was there for about eight and a half years all in all. And yeah, Crikey. I was employee number 3 when I left. It was about 80 people. It's wow. even bigger wow, now. So yes, it's, you know, I did. So they CX Partners are a big UX agency, one of the best in the UK, the world, some may say.
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. They're very good. They put out some great stuff as well. So you didn't get share options and you're not sitting on a big mountain of gold then, like Smaug.
Well, I think we've talked about it before. The last time I was on the show, we talked about the economics of running a design agency. There isn't a large amount of money behind a design agency, really. No. So did have share options. And were they worth very much? Not enough for me to want to stay around long term.
No.
I think short of getting bought by a bank or a large management consultancy, most design agencies, it's quite unusual, you know, quite unusual to be able to make it, to retire on the proceeds from selling an agency. And especially if you're not quite an employer, but an early employee, no way are you ever going to make a fortune from a sale, unfortunately.
So now it's just you.
Just me, yes. I'm
doing your thing. Which, as we concluded when we went out for lunch, is the life of Riley.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's I guess that was what you said. I said, when it's good, it's great. And it's fantastic, but when it's not good, it's really hard work because it is just you. So, you know, it goes both ways, really. And at the moment, things are good, but, you know, equally, there's times when things have been harder and you've not got anybody to help.
I know. I'd hate to be on my own. That'd be awful.
Yeah, and I do still miss you guys, actually. Especially, like Joe says, when it comes to some big decision or something difficult, it's you know, it is frustrating when you're trying to kind of work that through yourself. And, you know, you talk to other people about it, but they don't really understand the business properly. And, you know, so it's got its pros and its cons. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely it has.
Definitely. The biggest pro, I think, of being on your own is that you can just think, you know what, it's 11 in the morning, I'm knocking off today.
Yeah.
Whereas I can't really do that. I can, but I can't.
You can, you're the boss, you can do that. You can say,
there's another boss that never stops working. That's
he's terrible.
Well, even better, that's even more reason for you to take some time off.
Yeah, but he's very good at making you feel guilty.
Totally.
He's got that kind of passive aggressive guilt trip thing down to an absolute T. Especially when you go out and buy a kit without asking him.
I just do that now.
Yeah, and he's still, you know, he's like, you know, my iPhone 5 is perfectly fine. Why do you need to upgrade every time? You know.
Yes. Nah.
Oh, we're so mean to Chris, because he doesn't deserve it. He's lovely.
He's very lovely. He's also poorly today, bless him.
Oh, is he? Oh, yeah. He doesn't often get poorly.
No. Well, I don't know. He's just got a bit of a cold. And he's got to go out to London tonight for a workshop tomorrow. Ooh. Which is particularly miserable if you've just got a cold coming on.
It really is.
Nice. Anyway.
R for Chris. Right, let's talk about...
On, forget
about
him.
Yeah, that's enough of that. let's talk about Balsamic, our sponsor, and then we'll actually get into the discussion, because I've just looked at the clock and realised how much time we've wasted, as usual. So Balsamic is now web-based. Chances are you've heard of Balsamic before. Most people have. Most people have used it. But you might not know that it's moved. You can still get the application, you just download and do the rest of it, but there is a web-based version of it now called Balsamic Cloud, which is perfect for collaboration because it's got things like built-in threaded comments with call-outs, but it also allows real-time collaboration, and it's even got like a chat panel and all of that kind of stuff you'd expect for collaboration. So you can have multiple project owners with specific project editors and reviewers. So you could do all that kind of permission stuff. You could do public reviews and comments by publishing basically a link, and it gives you a link that you can then share around wherever you want. So, and of course, this is great for getting the whole team involved in creating wireframes and expressing their ideas. And of course, it's balsamic, so it's really easy to use. It's just drag, drop and resize, which obviously is perfect for non-designer types. You could get a free 30-day trial of it where you just give it a go. If you decide you want to sign up, when you enter your billing information, if you use the code BALSAMICBOAG, you'll also get 3 months for free at the start of your paid account version. So to get all of that, to give it a try, to have a little play, go to balsamic.cloud. Great. Okay.
I really love balsamic. It's one of those tools I keep going back to that I think is fantastic. If you want to get some just quick ideas out, it's so fast. I love it for that. It's brilliant. Yeah. It's such a great little tool. So well done, Balsamic. Keep going.
Exactly. Now, it's funny. I have to leave extra time every time I talk about Balsamic for whoever the guest is to inevitably say they really like Balsamic, because it's just one of those tools that it's so simple. I think that's the thing.
Tempting to say I think it's rubbish.
Go on then.
Oh, I said it, didn't I? Yeah. No, I don't think it's
I know you don't mean it, Mike. Nobody does. It's Balsamic. How can you criticize? Criticizing Balsamic would be like criticizing a newborn baby. It would just be wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You can't do it, can you?
No.
Anyway, what we want to talk about, so we want to talk about persuasion and creating compelling interfaces, because we're doing a season on UI design. Now, this is something that I'm very much into. I run workshops on it. I write about it quite a lot. But unlike Joe, I have no qualifications in this field whatsoever and are just making it up as I go along. So we thought, let's get a grown up on the show to talk about it as well. So we couldn't get a grown up, so we got Joe instead.
Hey, there we go.
Ah, I know. It's people listen to this for my witty banter. Right. So, okay, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, in my opinion at least, we call ourselves designers. We're not artists, we're designers. Now, a designer creates something with a purpose to it, right? It's to achieve certain goals, right? And that means that ultimately the websites that we produce have to meet some kind of objective, right? Mm-hmm. Typically, that would be increasing leads, increasing signups, increasing sales, something along those lines. Okay. And here's the problem that I see it as designers that we face, is that we can do those things. There are lots of ways and means that we can achieve that kind of stuff. And especially if you get a bit of an understanding of psychology and the principles of persuasion, you can do quite a lot to get people to convert. So where's the line in all of this? Where's the ethics in this? Joe, do you have like any kind of rule of thumb in terms of how far you can push things?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. So I've been around long enough to have worked. So one of my very first projects actually at CX Partners was with a high street bank. And it was during the time of PPI insurance, which I'm sure you all know about, which is the insurance they used to bundle with loans and credit cards, where effectively it was, you know, payment and protection insurance. And I remember being put under a lot of pressure early on to use some of the psychology stuff that I'd learned to better sell PPI insurance. And for me, I felt very uncomfortable to it, because it's, again, so my line really is what that episode taught me about working for that high street bank, who've now had to pay millions and millions and millions in compensation for that stuff, is that I wouldn't want to lie or to cheat or to do something that I would feel uncomfortable if this was presented to me. That's really where my line is. So I don't lie, I don't cheat, and I wouldn't do something that would, I suppose, make me feel uncomfortable if I was in that particular situation. And that's my rule around it. And I that's where my line sits.
It's really interesting because I was recently presenting at UX Bournemouth on persuasive design, and somebody asked me that question. And just before I'd gone on the stage, I was chatting with the other speaker about it, which was a guy called Johnny Ray Evans, who works for the Big Lottery Fund. And he came up with a really good kind of rule of thumb, which is, imagine somebody went through your website and got to the end of the process and they'd purchased whatever, or they'd converted. And if at that point you explained to them all of the tricks and techniques and things you had done on that site in order to persuade them to buy, if they knew all of that at the very end of the process, would you feel comfortable them knowing it? And if you feel uncomfortable with them knowing it, the chances are you've pushed it too far. And I thought that was quite a nice way of viewing it, actually. Does that make sense? Have I explained?
It's a really nice way of doing it, I think, because you're right. If people are often, half the time, aren't aware of what's going on, and they have this sort of subtle awareness subconsciously that something doesn't quite feel right. It feels a bit murky. And I think you all get that experience. I mean, booking.com is one of the I've got a lot, the booking.com team all extremely smart, but the danger they have is that every time you go on booking.com you feel slightly murky because of they do far too much of this. They're constantly applying small psychological pressures to you at every one point, and it doesn't feel particularly nice. So absolutely, to the point about, you know, if you were to explain to people everything that had been done, and people would feel weird about coming back to someone like booking.com for doing it. So I'm there. I shy away from even using the term persuasive stuff, and often a lot of the tricks that are used I steer away from, because I just don't feel comfortable doing it, basically.
It's really interesting you bring up booking.com. I literally, just before I came here to record this, I was down the coffee shop, because Marcus, I can go to the coffee shop whenever I want, because I don't have another partner to rely on. And I was meeting with my parents, and we were chatting, and they...
Only one room left now. It's going to go. 30 seconds, you're going to miss it. One room left.
Yes, exactly. 15 people. Yeah. 15 people are looking at this room. 15 people are just booked 2 minutes ago. It's all there.
So we were down, and we were talking about booking hotel rooms, and my dad actually mentioned booking.com by name, and he says that he books there quite regularly. But this is what he said. He said, "I do not trust them as far as I can throw them. The only reason I use that site is because it's easy." And for me, that kind of said it all, that the psychological tricks can be so dangerous and can actually undermine. And probably the best thing you can do if you want to improve conversion and encourage loyalty and engagement, stuff like that, is actually not to persuade anybody of anything, but just to make the experience as easy as possible. I mean, it was a great little comment. It was really good.
And it makes sense, because again, you think about, so psychology isn't just about persuasion. I think that's the other myth that comes around, because I use psychology in lots of different types of it, and so a lot of this stuff around the kind of this idea of the dark arts, that's the bit that's quite, you know, exciting and sexy and interesting right now. You know, the whole government setting up the Nudge Unit to get this stuff done. There's a lot of interest around that world of it, because it seems easy, and I think that's the story behind a lot of this stuff. Is you just do a few of these psychological tricks and you can increase the conversion rates. If you look at the conversion rates, so again, I used to done a lot of work with Marriott over the years, Late Rooms, lastminute.com. None of them have the conversion rate that booking.com has. Booking.com has by far and away in the industry, you know, the highest conversion rate by 5 or 6%. It's huge. And that is simply because they are not afraid to use this stuff. So they don't care. Well, they say they do, but they don't care. They really don't care. Their main interest is selling more, as many hotel rooms as they possibly can.
Do you think that damages them over the long term?
I mean, it does. But the thing being is that they are fairly dominant in this space right now. They've pretty much put everybody else, you know, out of business. There are other people out there to do it, but booking.com is the one. They have the largest search spend. So if you're searching for hotels, that's the one that typically comes up. And they're very good at making you want to come back again. So they have got a lot of addictive elements to what they're doing as well. So, you know, it's like smoking. It's the same deal. Smoking, we know smoking bad for us, but people still do it and still continue doing it. It's like necessarily equate booking.com with smoking, but they use a lot of the addictive stuff that's out there to get people to come back. And, you know, even though it's bad for them and they don't feel good about doing it, they still come back and they still use it. So and it's a lot about culture there as well, which is a different thing again.
Smoking is way more fun than booking.com.
Yeah. Way cooler.
Is it?
Definitely.
Is
way
it, cooler. But is it, Marcus? I mean, standing out in the rain and having a fag?
No, you don't sit out in the rain. You just only smoke in the summer.
Yeah, okay.
There we go.
Fair enough. That's that sorted then. That's good to... Kids, take up smoking. That's, I think, what Marcus is saying.
What Marcus is saying.
Only in the summer.
Only in the summer.
Yeah. But I mean, so that kind of brings me back to my ethical code of conduct. So the last thing that I often say with my code of conduct is that I always want to provide positive benefit from the stuff that I include.
Yeah.
And so if it's not a positive feeling that I'm inducing in people, I don't want to get involved in supporting and using that kind of stuff. Mm. You know, like booking.com, they use things like the scarcity effect, which is only two left, or they use things like the bandwagon effect, where, you know, 15 people are looking at this right now. They use all of these things, which are, do they provide positive benefit? No, they simply don't. They create feelings of anxiety and they increase bookings, but they're long term. Of course, it hurts the brand. People don't feel particularly strongly towards them. They're not a lovable brand in any way, shape or form. They're cheap. And they've got a lot of hotels, but that's about as far as the positives can go in terms of booking.com.
And the fact that the site is easy to use, because it is.
Well, it is. But when you look at it, I mean, it is. And they do, this is part of a lot of what they do. So they do a lot of A-B multivariant testing. They're huge on it. They've got one of the most prolific and talented multivariant A-B testing teams in the world. And it's because, you know, they're constantly evolving both the usability, but also the psychological elements. They'll not be afraid to throw it in and see if it works or not. So that's why their usability is good. They've evolved it. That's why their psychology is a little bit evil, because it does increase sales. And anytime you're awarding a team, which the conversion rate team are awarded around conversions, you're always going to fall foul, or the temptation's always going to be there in terms of getting your Christmas bonus to use slightly murky approaches to convert people. And that's what booking.com do.
And the downside of that is that the trouble with, I mean, I'm a huge fan of split testing, multivariate testing, all of that. But the trouble with it is it depends on what you're tracking. And it's very easy to track increases in conversion. It's much harder to track dissatisfaction or negative brand impressions.
Definitely.
You know, and so that's why you end up with this short-termism in terms of, you know, what you can or should do.
Yeah, and it goes the same way with the bonus structure these organizations have. So they'll all be getting their bonuses based on that as well. So that amplifies it even more. If your tools are set up to hit the metric and your bonus is set up to hit the metric, that's what you're going to focus on doing. It's abundantly true. I mean, a good example is I used to work a lot with the train lines. You know the train line?
Online.
So I worked on, actually the current design is still live on the website. I did a lot of work on that. And back when I was doing that, there was a lot of pressure there to sell third-party products. So there was a third-party products team. They've now left, so I can tell the story about it. And part of that was when you initially booked tickets through the train line, travel insurance was pre-ticked. Okay, so travel insurance is pre-included. And we hoped that people wouldn't notice that it was included and we'd make an extra couple of quid on each train booking. And part of one of my proudest moments of that project was removing that. And part of the challenge was then, well, you know, because they'd spent a lot of time and effort in getting the psychology right to include travel insurance. And the part of the problem was also that there was a team of three of them working on it at the train line. So there were three salaries that had to be paid for out of the money they made from travel insurance. So for me to go in and say, well, hey, do you know what? Ethically and brand-wise, you shouldn't be selling travel insurance. That's really hard if you're the person sat in the room who's head of travel insurance, and I'm basically saying you're not going to meet your end of term targets, and you're probably going to lose your job because the numbers of travel insurance sales are going to go through the floor, because again, we want to sell more train tickets, less travel insurance. And we did, and we talked about it, and sure enough, that team left. But overall, the perceptions towards the train line are vastly different to before that project started, in terms of being the people's champion a bit more, you know, not including rubbishy travel insurance for a train ticket. I mean, who needs travel insurance for a train ticket? Nobody does. So you know, these things can change and organizations can change, but the very structures of organization can often encourage nefarious use of psychology, which is often why people call me, because, you know, I'm a psychologist.
It's so, also, but Mike Montero has been getting a lot of press lately, hasn't he? And I'm sort of, there was even a chat in the Bergwill Slack channel about this, because he's saying that designers need to take more responsibility for their actions. And it's a very easy thing to say, but as you were just saying, Joe, if your bonus depends on whether you're going to implement this kind of slightly shady thing, then it's not so clear cut, is it? Because is it really hurting anyone? You know, pressurising them into booking a hotel? Is that what Mike Montero means? I don't know. He kind of talks about it in relation to the people who are going to design the wall between America and Mexico. And yeah, all right, fair enough. But booking a hotel room?
Well, I agree with you. But it's that idea of, well, you know, is that hotel room going to be a more expensive hotel room? Is it a hotel room you would have booked for somebody else? Is it something you shouldn't be spending your money on? You know, there's a whole load of ethical lines there as well. And I agree, you know, booking a hotel room is not the worst thing in the world. But PPI insurance, going back to the example that I worked on before, that was very much in that world where everybody's bonuses. So the product manager of the loans offering at the bank I was working at, his bonus was tied exactly to sales of PPI insurance, not sales of loans, because they made no money on loans. They made all their money on PPI. So that whole organization, and actually, do you know what? It was an ethical bank. It's one of those banks that is touted as being an ethical bank, the bank that I did this project in, which surprised me so much. But even so, those bonus structures are there. And so, you know, as a designer, I was tempted to be in that world. And you know, the most powerful psychology, I remember it well, the most powerful psychology you can put in. So again, if you think about a loan application, this was the temptation. The loan application is, you know, so you're doing a loan application. I know for a fact that, you know, you're married, you've got, say, three kids. I know the name of your partner. I know roughly how old your kids are. I could go back and say, oh, hey, Marcus, wouldn't it be awful if you lost your job? And wouldn't it be terrible if your wife and three kids had nobody to support them? Maybe you should consider taking out PPI insurance. And that was that was what I was asked to design, was something along those lines, was to use the information we gathered from this loan application to sell PPI. And I was just appalled at that. And when I said to the guy about that, he was like, well, it's fine. It's not hurting anybody. They're getting the protection they need. They're still going to get their loan. They're getting a good deal. It's not hurting anybody. And, well, you know, fast forward where we are now, it's proven to be dishonest from a legal point of view.
Don't get me wrong. I'm with Mike Montero on this. And
I'm with Mike on it.
And I don't like Booking.com's pressurization techniques. Like everything in life, it's not black and white, is it?
Okay, well, all right, I'll play devil's advocate in this then, right? We live in a capitalist society, okay? Mm-hmm. We also live in a liberal society where people make their own decisions about stuff. So, you know, if our role as designers is to provide a service to businesses and they hire us to do that, should we not do that to the best of our ability and deliver that service and leave it to individual consumers to make up their minds about what they, you know, what they're going to do and what they're not? You know, okay, yes, sites like booking.com do pressure them and do harass them, but will not eventually the market adjust itself that people will get pissed off with booking.com and go elsewhere? And is it not our job as designers, mm-hmm. you know, that if a company hires us to increase conversion, we do our best to do that? I'm not sure I believe this, but
depends on what techniques you're using to make that happen. I guess you've got to ask yourself, is this right and am I happy about doing it? Sure. Mm.
This is something I believe in. So I've worked with gambling organisations over the past. I worked with Betfair for I did a big project for them a few years ago. And I thought, well, I'll try it. I'll see what the gambling industry's like. And again, mm-hmm. the pressure was there to use a lot of this stuff to get people to gamble more. And it appalled me. And I'm never going to work for a gambling organisation again. I thought I'd give the benefit of the doubt and I'll see. But it's an organisation that I didn't enjoy working for. And Betfair, you know, everybody was really nice and really smart. Same with everybody I've met at Booking.com. They're really nice, really smart, really affable, friendly, nice people. But you set the culture slightly wrong in an organisation and it can go a bit weird. And betting, you know, Betfair was equally the same way. It was just, it felt wrong encouraging people to gamble more. Mm. I've also turned down lots of work with, because I do a lot in financial services, with like the payday loans companies as well. Yeah. Because again, similarly, they're they're talking about making loans easy for people, and that's their whole thing, is you can get money easily and quickly. And the reality is, the reason you get your money easy and quickly is because you're paying a fortune for it. And so, yeah, I think you're right, but it's up to us to decide if that business is worthy of our... That sounds really... What's the word I'm looking for? Arrogant.
Worthy
of us, but worthy, yeah. And
yeah, and you do have to make a... You do have to make a moral decision. Absolutely. I think that the key, mine, is where I maybe would differ slightly from the prevailing view at the moment, is that that's down to an individual designer to make that decision. And that if, you know, you turned around and worked for a gambling company and specialized in that, I wouldn't view you less in any way. It would just be a choice that you've made that is a choice that I wouldn't make. Does that make sense? So people that are working at booking.com, I don't have a problem with them working at booking.com, for example. But that's just personal preference.
But it's good for us to if they do work at booking.com, just to say, what are you guys up to? Is this right, what you're doing here? Do you agree with what you're doing? So there needs to be a foil. Does equally web professionals, because again, booking.com sponsor loads of the conferences I go to and speak at, and they're the terrific sponsor of the web, huge supporter of the web industry as a whole. But you know, that needs to be kept in check slightly. People need to say, are you sure you're doing the right thing at this point? Are you sure that that's right? But you're right, I agree, it is up to the individual designer, but it needs people like us and Mike to keep saying, keep people thinking about it, because it's easy to start really small with only two items left like this you're looking at. That's how it starts. You see a small uplift in conversion from, you know, the scarcity effect of only two of these left. That's where you start, and you think, well, that worked. Maybe we can do some more of that. Maybe we can do some more of that. Maybe we can do some more of that. Before you know it, you've got 50 of these persuasive techniques on your site, and you know, yes, you're earning more money, but at what cost?
Yeah, and that's the key for me, is you can argue about morality all that you want, and everybody has slightly different views on morality, but I think it's more important to consider, you know, from a hard-nosed business point of view, and actually encouraging change in these organizations, to start revealing the negative costs that are associated with these techniques, how it damages brand identity, how it creates buyer's remorse, that it leads to more cancellations, more support queries, all of those kinds of things. But I do want to just move on from this, because I don't want to just bash psychology and persuasion,
because I'm with you, because there's loads of great stuff out there. I could give you loads. Psychology can transform. I use psychology and, you know, help to transform businesses by using it, so it can have an amazing transformative effect if it's used the right way.
Go on then, give me some examples of how psychology can be used in a positive way to improve, you know, businesses experiences, business brand identity, all that kind of stuff.
So there's effectively two ways to look at it. So if we stay with somebody like, say something like booking.com. So a classic theory within psychology is the theory of mental models. And the theory of mental models is how we build models of the world around us. So we build a model of the world around us, and we take that model and we apply it to new and interesting and different situations. So I take the example of going to Starbucks to order a coffee, right? We all know how to order a coffee at Starbucks. You know, you go in, you queue up, you order your coffee, you pay for your coffee, you collect your coffee, and you sit down. And then you contrast with that. And that's how we, as humans, have built a mental model about how to order and buy coffee in the UK and in the US. Mm-hmm. We then take that mental model of how to drink coffee, and we take it to say, Parisian, a cafe in Paris. Mm-hmm. And what happens there is that... have you ever been in that situation? I don't know if you've ever been there, where you go to a cafe like that, and you leave without paying. And you're like, oh, have you paid? Have we paid yet? Oh, we haven't paid yet. Have we paid? And sometimes you're halfway down the street and you haven't paid. And that's a classic example of when mental models go a bit wrong. So again, obviously when you're buying and ordering a coffee at a coffee shop or a cafe in Paris, you know, you go and you sit down, the waiter brings you the menu, you order from the waiter, he brings your coffee, you drink your coffee, you ask for the bill comes, and you pay for it and you go. But your mental model is very much in the Starbucks world of, oh, you finish your coffee and you leave because you've paid right back when you ordered your coffee in the first place. And the mental model theory from psychology can have absolute transformative effects in terms of the way you can change a user experience. So a good example would be back in travel again. So when people are booking travel, in the mental model of how we do it is typically, if you know, if we're going away for a weekend, we'll say things like, oh, let's go away for the weekend. Yeah, where should we go? Do you fancy the beach? Yeah, yeah, the beach, somewhere warm would be really nice. Or maybe a city break. Oh, yeah, that sounds nice. When should we go? And you're like, well, what days can we get away? What day's a weekend? What day does a weekend start? I'll ask you both. What day does a weekend start? A long weekend. What day?
Friday.
Thursday? Sometimes Thursday. You can go away for a weekend from Thursday to Sunday, can't you? Or Friday to Monday?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Friday to Sunday. You know, that's the thing. We'll go away for a long weekend. Perfect. Let's go for somewhere hot. Yeah, let's go somewhere hot. You've got that mental model of how to book a holiday. So you want to go somewhere hot. You want to go away for the weekend. You're not, I mean, how far are you going to go for the weekend? How far would you travel for the weekend?
Yeah, you're not going to go that far, are you? So that's going to
give me an example. How far?
Oh, you could go to
Spain.
Yeah.
And how would you measure that? Would you measure that in miles? Would you decide how far?
How long the flight is.
Flight time.
How long the flight is. Exactly, yeah. It's the flight time. So most people say we'll go away for an hour or 3 hours. You know, maybe 1 and 3 hours flight time away. That's how people book holidays. They're like, oh, let's go somewhere hot. We'll go away for a long weekend and we'll go for 3 hours. And then when the reality of that mental model hits the reality of most travel sites, they ask you for which city do you want to go to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which destination do you want to go to? So, Neil, you need to know your start point and your end point. They need to know the date. They're like, which date do you want to go? And it's DDMMYY. You know, exactly the days you're going to go. And there is a simple piece of psychology that could transform Booking.com's experience rather than this persuasive crap they're doing. Whereas if they just said, show me places 3 hours away from London or 3 hours away from Bristol or 3 hours away from where I am. That's a fantastic way to search for somewhere. So show me hot places that are 3 hours away from where I am. I want to go maybe on the Thursday or the Friday and stay for 2 or 3 nights. That is the perfect way to design a travel website, not, you know, two beds left.
Yeah.
Rant over. So that's the transformative effect, is by looking at how people build mental models of the world around them and do this stuff and apply that to your stuff.
So there are other examples of that kind of, you know, quirks of human behavior that we should be taking more consideration of?
Yeah, I mean, that's on the big scale. So that's the big stuff. So that's kind of a good way to transform a user experience, is to get some right ideas. You know, dare I use it, the word innovation in that stuff.
Yeah.
But it can go right down to... So again, within psychology, we have two types of knowledge. We have declarative knowledge and we have procedural knowledge. So declarative knowledge is stuff like dates, capital cities, kings, you know, name Henry VIII's third wife. Who's Henry VIII's third wife? Do you know?
No idea.
How did she meet her end, Henry VIII's third wife?
I can never remember this blooming stupid rhyme, so I couldn't tell you.
Another one for you. What the points of a compass? What are the points of the compass? How do you remember what the points of a compass are?
Never eat shredded wheat. There
Naughty elephant squirt water.
Naughty elephant squirt. We've got two ways of doing it. So knowing which is east and west, which is the hard bit from knowing the points of a compass, that's declarative knowledge. It's, you know, pulling out that fact from your head is declarative.
Yeah.
We as humans convert that into the other type of knowledge, which is procedural knowledge, which is a knowledge around flow. And so we use terms like never eat shredded wheat to help us remember the points of a compass. So northeast, southwest is the order that they go in. Never eat shredded wheat. We're converting the very difficult to remember declarative to the very easy to remember procedural. And we do this with everything that we do. Everything becomes a process and a flow. The way we remember how to do something is through a process and through a flow. So again, classically, if you ever had the situation where you've forgotten your PIN number for an ATM or cash machine, you ever forgotten the PIN number? Right.
Yeah.
What's the best way to remember the PIN number? Is it to start thinking in your head what the PIN number is? What's the best way to do it?
Well, either to write it down or alternatively to do something that's already memorable.
Well, the best way to remember it. So if you forget what your PIN number is, the best way for you to remember it, if you're giving it to somebody else, like somebody else, oh, can you get some money out for me? Yeah, of course. What's your PIN number? Oh, I can't remember what PIN number.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Is to imagine yourself going through the steps of going to the cash machine, or even actually going to the cash machine. If you go through the steps in your head, you go to... Right, go down to the cash machine. You know, that's classic procedural knowledge. You'll remember, you'll be able to pull out what your PIN number is from the process of knowledge. So step one reminds you what step two is, which reminds you of step three. And step three might be your PIN number. Step four, step five, step six. So everything that's encoded in our brains is encoded as part of a process or a sequence or a flow. So when effectively we're trying to pull stuff out of our heads, we're rubbish at remembering declarative knowledge facts, but we're really good at remembering processes and flows. And so we take a good example of, say, designing a search box. Where would you expect to find a search box on a website? Quickly.
Top right.
Intuitively, our procedural knowledge tells us to go top right to instigate a procedural knowledge flow of how we're going to do it. You know, you look for a text field, you look to type something in, you look for a button to press, blah, blah, blah. You know, again, step one is to go to the top right. Step two is to look for the form field and type something in. Step three is to hit the button. Step four is to go to the search results page. Classic procedural knowledge flow about how to do a search. Most people who use the internet are utterly familiar with how that works. Until some fancy designer decides to remove the search button because it looks a lot cleaner without a search button there. And of course, everybody knows how to hit return. The problem then comes is that you've broken the procedural knowledge flow of how people search. There's no button there, so people don't know how to get to the next step. So that flow of procedural knowledge has been broken. So a good tip for designing interactions is to list out on a very, very basic level the procedural knowledge flow of undertaking that particular interaction, be it search is the one I mentioned there, be it getting back to the homepage, going to the contact us page. All of that stuff is to plot out on a micro level the procedural knowledge flow that people expect to go through and design towards that. And that's going to help you be a better designer, far better than just going, oh, it's much cleaner now we've taken the search box out.
So is that how you tend to start a project, is start by mapping out these procedural flows?
No, generally, honestly, I start bigger. So I start with the mental model. So I start the mental model I talked about before. So, one I talked about the going away for a weekend for 3 hours. And I come up with a very basic mental model, like that statement I just talked about there, like going away somewhere hot for the weekend for 3 hours. And I use that then to base everything around in terms of the design. So if we've got that initial mental model right, we're going to be in a good place. And then when it comes down to the level of the interaction beneath it, then you sort of map out each of the individual steps of that interaction at a real micro level based on the procedural knowledge of how somebody would expect that interaction to work. You know, what buttons should look like, what color, what form field should look like, you know, keeping it really basic. So effectively you're getting the usability right with the procedural knowledge, but you're getting the experience right with the mental model theory. That's the best way to approach it.
That's a really interesting way of approaching things, and not something I'd consider, to be honest. We've messed up this show. Do you know, we haven't left anywhere near. Yeah, I think we have. We need to start again because we spent far too long.
We could have a part two.
We could do. I think we're going to have to return to this subject because I've got so many more questions, and yet we're already 52 minutes in. So I think I'm going to have to wrap it up. For now, that conversation, but I do want to get you back on, Joe, because there's a whole load of other stuff that I want to cover in regards to psychology, because I find it a really interesting area, and you know, just the quirks of our behavior and the decision making that we make and how we go about making decisions is an enormously complicated area. But for now, we shall call it a day. I do want to quickly talk about Full Story, which is our second sponsor, and they're a session recorder. Now, you might think to yourself, why do I want to be able to replay sessions? What is the value of that to me? And there are so many tools in our arsenal already that give us this kind of perception of how people are using projects. I'll put products that we produce, everything from analytics through to all kinds of different tools that are out there. But a lot of them tend to be kind of give more general, statistically accurate representations. But nothing quite beats that visceral and personal understanding that is given from watching real users interact with your pages completely naturally. So session players can uncover all kinds of UX and general design issues that can't be easily sussed out either from a user interview or from standard analytics. And in fact, even in some cases from usability testing, because people behave differently when they know they're being watched, etc. So of all the session recorders out there, why Full Story in particular? Well, that's because, in my opinion, it's the best session recorder out there. It's got the highest fidelity in its playback, which means it's recording every single event on the page. And you can search on absolutely every single event that's happening, from what you know, what pieces of text the user's selecting, to what they're clicking on, the whole lot. So you can even see things like, you know, whether users have been furiously rage clicking on a button that hasn't reacted as they expected it to, and it's got all kinds of in-depth insights that you can get really simply from even saying, you know, show me everybody that's interacted with this CSS class, for example. You can do all kinds of stuff. So if you sign up for today, you get a month free of their pro account, and then after that you can continue to use it for up to 1,000 sessions per month for absolutely free, as long as you want to. When you set up an account, there's no need to enter a credit card or anything like that. So, you know, you can, I often, for example, just use the 1,000 sessions to test a particular page or a particular issue that I'm having on one part of the site. So you could do that by going to fullstory.com/BOAG. I wanted to give you a little bit of kind of further research on the whole issue of psychology and encouraging people to take action. The first one, to be honest, is a bit of a plug. I'm running an online version of my persuasive design workshop that I run coming up beginning of May, which is a live four-part workshop. So it happens in 4 1.5-hour sessions over a period of a month. Lots of chance to ask questions, lots of chance to delve into everything from you know, some of the interesting elements of human psychology all the way down to how to design a good call to action button that people actually spot and use. You can find out more about that at boag.world/convert-workshop. The second one, obviously, is Joe's amazing book on the subject, which you can get by going to boag.world/psych-book. I've written an article on calls to action in particular that's worth checking out, which is boag.world/CTA, call to action. Which kind of focuses more on visual design elements of designing a call to action that people actually notice and use. Then there's, you might want to check out The Brain Lady on Twitter, twitter.com/TheBrainLady. She's written some great books on various aspects of psychology, and even trumps Joe in terms of qualifications, because she's got a doctorate, don't
she?
She has,
yes. She's great as well. Very smart lady.
Very smart. Yeah, and then finally, you might want to check out cards.ui-patterns.com, which is a bit like my user experience cards, but looking at kind of quirks of human behavior and psychology that may be useful to you as a designer. So that about wraps it up. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
I do. This one's from Paul van den Doel, which I think is the correct way to pronounce it, from the Slack channel. And it's kind of relevant to what day it was on Sunday. I'm going to buy my mum a refrigerator for Mother's Day. I can't wait to see her face light up when she opens it.
That is quite a good one. Brilliant. I quite like that one. But you didn't use my joke, Marcus.
As I explained in my reply to you, Paul, it would be the second time it would have been on the podcast, and it just proves that you never listen to a word I say.
Oh, really? We've done the beef stew joke before?
Yeah, of course we have.
Oh. Oh, I like that joke.
Has that ruined your day? Do it again. People will love it. Not, we have a different audience every week.
No, I'm not going to now. You've ruined it. If you want to see your joke featured on the podcast, or indeed to go and find out my beef stew joke, you can join us on Slack by going to boagworld.com/slacking. Please, especially if you are a UX person, please join our Slack channel, because at the moment it's nothing but developers droning on about crap I don't understand. They're all, they just bore me senseless. They really do. No, I was teasing them about it recently, so because I don't understand a lot of what they're saying anymore. So, yeah, more UX people in our Slack channel. Joe, where can people find out more about you?
My website's at mrjoe.uk or mrjoe on Twitter.
And that also, that covers... it doesn't cover hiring you as well. I wondered whether you had a separate Hire Me site.
It's all there. No, it's all there. It's all on Mr. Joe. So on Mr. Joe, you can find, if you want to work with me, I can help you apply psychology to what your designs. You can also, I also run workshops in-house workshops for teams on including and designing psychology into your design process on there too. And of course, my book's there as well. So it's all there at mrjoe.uk.
Lovely jubbly. So next week, we're going to be looking at what the role... Oh, for crying out loud. After just what I said about Slack and it all being about developers, next week, we're going to have a look at what the role of the developer is in interface design.
There we go.
That's going to be fun, isn't it?
No, no, they're so important. Will be.
They are massively important, and that's why I kind of included it. But yes. Because I'm being grumpy about developers for no apparent reason. Yes. But no, I'm looking forward to it, actually. We've got Aslan coming on the show, Marcus. Do you remember Aslan?
Of course I do. Lovely man. Excellent. He does good jokes. Hopefully he'll bring one or two along.
Okay, well, let's hope so. But for now, Joe, thank you so much for coming on. It was really good to talk to you yet again. And we'll meet up before too long when there isn't a mic up to you.
Oh, I don't know. Do this again soon.
All right. Thank you very much. And goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.